Corruption Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for April 20th, 2005, Wednesday. And this is a public hearing on Senate Bill 5522, the Oregon Health and Science University. Colleagues, our chair, Senator Devlin, will be arriving shortly. And Mr. Bender, would you like to walk us through what we will be hearing today?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today is the first day of the actual agency presentation for Phase 2 for OHSU. Again, as you know, the subcommittee will not be meeting tomorrow, and the second and final day of agency presentation for Phase 2 will be on next Monday. What I would like to do, if I may, Madam Chair, just briefly start out the discussion, first of all, by indicating some of the materials that you have in front of you. OHSU has distributed a new three-ring binder for you with all of their Phase 2 materials together. This does replace some of the materials, or update some of the materials in the back of your white binder that you'd received for Phase 1. But if it's more convenient for you, you might just want to take all of this and put it in the back of one binder so you only have one to carry around. It probably will fit all in one particular binder, but maybe not. I don't know.
I don't think so.
Some of the other materials that have been distributed to you this morning include a governor's recommended budget item that Mr. McGee from Budget and Management will be going over after I'm done with my little overview here. But I've distributed two items to you that I'd like to draw your attention to start off the discussion of Phase 2 for OHSU. One of them is an excerpt from our LFO analysis of the governor's recommended budget. It's the portion on OHSU, which you might want to keep with your materials here since it does contain some summary information on both their operations and their budget. The other item that I've distributed is a set of graphs and other materials with this chart on the top of it. There are extra copies available for the audience on the table there, and in those extra copies, they'll be in black and white and not in color. But if I may, Madam Chair, just briefly go through this as a sort of background of the budget for OHSU that is before you today. In this handout that I prepared, this first chart shows some historical information on the amount of state support for OHSU. OHSU is not a state agency. They are a public corporation. And because they're a public corporation, you budget for them differently than you do for a standard state agency, in the sense that you do not tell them how much money they're allowed to spend. Typically, for a state agency, you indicate this is how much you can spend and this is where the money's coming from. For OHSU, what the state does is they provide support in the form of operating grants, and then there's no limitation on their expenditures. So these grants are used with their other sources of revenues to finance the OHSU operations. In many ways, though, OHSU, the way OHSU is funded, is not unusual for the agencies that you have before you in the subcommittee, because this is very similar to the way that both community colleges and K-12 school districts are funded, in the sense that the state provides money, but you are not approving the individual school district budgets or the individual community college district budgets, just as you are not approving the OHSU university budget. What this chart identifies is it identifies funds that the state has been providing to OHSU, the amount of these funds, these are all in millions of dollars, since the 1999-01 biennium. And you can see here that there are three separate types of funds, or I should say targets, that the state is funding with the money it's providing. Let me mention one thing, however, before I even start with these numbers, is that these are not the only state general fund dollars that end up going to OHSU. OHSU receives other dollars, but the dollars that it receives otherwise are primarily payments for the services that OHSU is providing. So, for example, in the state's Medicaid program, a lot of general fund dollars are going there, and a substantial portion of those general fund dollars end up going to OHSU, but that is not in direct support. That's in payment of OHSU's medical services to Medicaid patients. There are also some other funds that do go to OHSU that do not show up here in this particular budget that come from the state, but they are typically providing grant support for particular operations such as the CROET, which is the Center for Occupational Research and in employment toxicology. I got that wrong, but there's some. They also receive monies that are not shown here. In the dark blue, these are the monies that are being provided to OHSU to support a number of functions. And we'll go into that in more detail, in much more detail in the next 2 days, but even I'll go into that in a bit more detail in just a minute. The yellow, which is shown for two biennia, 0103 and 0305, were funds that the state provided to support the OHSU Oregon Opportunity Program, which is an expansion of the university's research capacity and research institutions. This was provided not in the form of general fund. These yellow amounts that you see, which sum up to about $200 million in total over the two biennia that they were provided in the form of bond proceeds. These were state general obligation bonds that were provided to OHSU to help expand their biotechnology and research programs. These funds, the state is obligated to pay debt service on these bonds. And you can see the debt service amounts are shown in the light blue. So the light blue shows that the debt service first started becoming due in 0103 at $5.1 million. Here in the governor's recommended budget, it's at the level of $32 million. And this number will not increase in the future. It's fully phased in now, and this will extend for the full 20-year life of these bonds.
The 32, Madam Chair.
Our representative is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 32. It's going to be 32 constants.
Correct.
For 20 years.
20 years. Yes. These, and by the way, these monies, even though the state is providing them and you fund them through the OHSU budget, don't actually go to OHSU. They never receive these funds. It doesn't go through their books. These are just used to pay off the bonds that were issued on behalf of the Oregon Opportunity Program for OHSU. The dark blue funds are the ongoing support of the education and clinical missions and service missions of OHSU. And if you turn to the second page here, this gives you a little more detail of both the $85.8 million that was provided in 0305 and the $53 million that is in the governor's recommended budget for OHSU. And it shows where those funds go. This, you can see that there are a number of sources that receive these funds. And I've listed those here. Hospitals, the hospitals and clinics, were basically getting about $13.7 million under the governor's revised budget. Those funds are eliminated. And they receive no funding from the state for hospitals and clinics. You can see the three schools. There are actually three schools within OHSU that received general fund support in 0305. Medicine got about $29 million, dentistry about $12.5 million, and nursing about $15 million. You can see the reductions there and the percent reductions in the governor's recommended budget. There are a lot of entities or units within OHSU that do not receive general fund support at all, and I've not attempted to list all of these, but I did list one of them, and that is the OGI School of Science and Engineering. That does not receive general fund, and the reason I listed that, even though I didn't try to list everything that doesn't get general fund, is just to clarify that there is another school out there at OHSU This is formerly was in the independent school OGI, and it is not. It does not receive. This school operates essentially as a private school and does not receive state general fund support. The CDRC, you heard a lot of testimony on that yesterday morning. You can see that the amounts were set $9.7 million and that there's about a 46% reduction in funding for the CDRC. So although the testimony may have made it sound like all of the funding was going away, that is not actually the case. There's just about half of that funding would be eliminated. There's the AHEC program and the Office of Rural Health. And then there's the Oregon Poison Center, which is really, in other materials that OHSU has presented to you, they've typically put this within their hospital and clinics line because they fund it as a part of a hospital and clinical budget. I'm showing it separately here because the state identified it as a separate line item both in 03-05, and the governor has done the same in his recommended budget for 05-07. This actually has an increase in support. The state provided $1.4 million of state support in 03-05, which was basically half the total cost of operating, or the estimated cost of operating the center. In the 05-07 biennium, the governor proposes general fund to support the entire estimated costs of the Oregon Poison Center. So that's an element that increases. I would like to indicate something I think is very important to note, and I'm sure Mr. McGee will talk about this further, but the governor's the support to OHSU last biennium, all of it was not provided on a line item basis. There was just one number for everything except the Oregon Poison Center and another number for the Oregon Poison Center. And OHSU, their board, divided the funds in the manner that you see here, 03-05, and there were discussions of this in subcommittee 2 years ago. So there was no surprises here. They indicated how they would be dividing this, and that's what they did. And this just shows how the funds were distributed in 03-05. When the governor made his recommendation, which included for these operating grants a decline of $32.8 million from the level of 03-05, all the governor did indicate was that the Oregon Poison Center was to receive $2.7 million of the remaining $53 million that was left. And the governor did not designate how the rest of the distribution was to be. This is a proposal that the OHSU Board of Directors has come up with. I think we can get more definitive comments from the university as to whether this was something that was actually approved or voted on or just discussed or what the level is. But this is the understanding, or at least their first, what they are telling the legislature, how they would distribute the $53 million in the governor's recommended budget if you were to approve that level. So indications, for example, a cut, if you look at the CDRC and you see a cut of $46.4 million, that decision to cut $4.5 million was actually made at the board level and not at the governor's level. The governor just presented a funding level, and the board then had to decide how to distribute the funds that would be available.
So, Madam Chair?
Good morning, Senator Walker.
Good morning. I was listening on TV while I was preparing to come down, and I would like Mr. Bender to repeat that explanation about it wasn't the governor's decision to cut those programs.
It was the governor's decision to reduce the amount of state support for OHSU operating grants to $53 million. And the only specific instruction that the governor gave was that $2.7 million of that $53 million was to be used to support the Oregon Poison Center. All of the other decisions as to how to distribute the remaining roughly $50 million that's left after you take out the $2.7 is a decision of the OHSU Board of Directors.
Thank you, Mr. Bender. Madam Chair, I thought that's what he said, but I wanted it to be stated again clearly And I'll make my point about that as we move along.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Was that the completion of your comments, Mr.
Of this page. The next page, which is the third page now in this handout, shows this is for the entire education program area. But if you look at the OHSU portion, it's toward the bottom half of this, you can see this shows a comparison of the governor's recommended budgets and what the House and Senate co-chairs' recommended budgets include for OHSU. And this ties back to the earlier page, where if you look, you could see the reduction numbers in the governor's recommended budget amount on the earlier page. But if you look at this particular chart, if you look at the right-hand most column where it says, in this column where there's a dash there, that's an indication where both the House and the Senate co-chairs are in agreement. And there are a lot, there are very few dashes here. So this is a case where the House and the Senate budgets are actually quite different from each other, more different than they are in many other cases. So if you look to see where there's agreement and where there isn't agreement, in both the House and the Senate co-chairs have agreed to reduce the amount of funding for the Oregon Poison Center essentially back to the level roughly that it was last biennium, instead of fully funding it as the governor did. And both of them have agreed to restoring the reduction in funding that the board of directors would approve for the School of Nursing. So they've both approved restoring $3.8 million for the School of Nursing. Otherwise, though, there's disagreement as to how to proceed with this budget. You could note that the House restores the funding cuts not only to the School of Nursing but also to the School of Medicine and Dentistry, whereas the Senate budget does not restore those cuts. In terms of the hospitals, the House restores essentially half that cut, and the Senate does not restore that cut. In terms of the CDRC reduction, the House does not restore that cut. The Senate does restore that reduction. And in terms of the reductions to rural health and AHEC, the House restores the reduction fully. The Senate restores half of the reduction. So there's actually a fair amount of difference in how the House co-chair and the Senate co-chair approach this particular budget.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Lesnar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bender, if the governor only, he left it up to OSHU how to spend the money, or what is our directions? We're supposed to go look at each function? If we're going to give it back to them, and they're going to have authority to spend it any way they're going to do anyway, I understand the exercise here. What is our guidance from the co-chairs or from leadership as far as, are we looking at a total amount to give them to decide how to do it? Are we going to look at each?
I think...
Does that make sense?
When we reach agreement on what the funding level is for the Oregon Health Sciences Center, I think it's very clear that we could create an expectation for where the funds would be spent. And should the funds not be spent in those manner, which I have no belief that they wouldn't be spent appropriately, that that might have an impact on the legislature's actions on the budget in the future. I have a feeling that there are actually at least four different areas of disagreement here. Disagreement between, one co-chair's version, another co-chair's version, and I think there are probably at least two or three more versions on this committee of where the funding levels should be and what should be funded. So, Representative Wisnett.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I'm understanding that we're going to go through the exercise of funding each department.
I think we will get to that point. Yes, Representative
Mr. Chair.
Jones.
And were implying in your last part, Mr. Bender, that the governor came up with these numbers in the GRB, or the governor's staff came up with those numbers. Is that, am I correct or incorrect? Or is that the agency?
That was the board of directors deciding.
Okay, the board of directors. So we got the governor's, I mean, there's a little bit of misnomer there, so that it's the governor's GRB. But actually, that is X dollars, and these numbers then are OHSU's numbers that they have in there. So as we balance back and forth, we're not fighting with the governor here on this. We may be fighting with him on the total amount, plus or minus, but these numbers are somewhat different. And I think if I understood my good colleague correctly, if we adjust the number from what the governor had recommended, it's probably still going to be OHSU that is going to fill in the blanks here, even though we may be making suggestions along this line. Is that correct?
Representative Jensen and members, there are, under law, the Board of Directors approves the budget, and to the extent that you do not indicate a specific use for the general fund, they can use it for any of their operations. So it is your decision. You can direct or require that the general fund be used for a specific school, for a specific hospital, for a specific program. It is completely within your authority to define how distinctly you want to direct the funds to be used.
Representative Jensen, I believe along those lines, I think one of the discussions I've at least heard from the Senate co-chair is there's some hope that we could, in terms of wherever we end up in terms of funding for OHSU, that we create some clear long-term understanding about what the obligations of the state are and the obligations of OHSU, so that we continue to have sometimes I think non-productive discussions we have some sessions, so that I think if we could create a clear understanding in this session, we'd probably be benefiting future sessions. Yes, Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair, I have some confusion and some disgruntlement. I'm not quite sure how to put it. Because in 1995, OHSU became a semi-independent agency. Now it has a board of directors that directs its money and its budget, yet it comes here with its handout to get a part of state money. That was the agreement at first. Yet we have no control over how they spend the rest of their money. We have no control over how much they pay their CEO. In fact, I'd like to know all of the benefit packages on top of the $600,000 salary. I'd like to know what that investment is for the tram and the South Waterfront. And all of those things they're sinking this money into, yet they bring the most vulnerable programs and the people here yesterday and make us feel horrid for cutting these programs, which we would be fools to cut that program. It serves the entire state. It's the only program in the state. They know it, and we know it. So I'm not getting the full picture here. All I'm getting is what they've brought to us and said, we're cutting this. Well, what other programs were eligible to be cut? And why don't we get to see the big budget picture? If we have a hand in this, then we need to see the whole picture. If we don't, then cut it loose and get the state out of the business of supporting OHSU. I'm just real confused about the direction and where we're supposed to be on this. And I need some guidance.
My understanding is that in 95, when this decision was made, that there was to be I may have the numbers a little bit wrong, but there was an expectation that for two bienniums, they would, OHSU would not come in with the request higher than how they'd been funded in the first biennium. And beyond that, there was probably no real solid agreement. And I think the issue was, what services do they provide that are of statewide significance or of significance to the community as a whole that would not be normally part of the normal operation that they currently have in terms of being a medical center, a research center, et cetera. I think part of this is, and it's probably one of the frustrations you might see in a number of areas, I can use a comparison that some members of the committee, I don't know how they'll react to it. We give money to every one of the 36 counties in this state, and we don't review their budgets either. So
they're not somebody independent, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
This is a corporation. And I, you know, Senator Schrader gave us all an open letter. There's no date on it, but I think you all got it. And he recommends that an interim work group be put together to put aside our differences and work out this healthy relationship with the state of Oregon and our flagship research institution. And I would agree. How that gets done, I don't know. But I tell you, I'm getting more irritated by the minute when I see this happen. When I see these vulnerable programs be the first up, and we don't get to see the rest of it. I mean, I'm going to ask that question this morning, is what other programs were available to CHOP?
Okay. Well, that's clearly appropriate, Senator Walker. I think at this point we should probably go into that, the discussion of the remainder of the issues before us. Is there anything additional, Mr. Bender?
I have some more material, but I think that since I'm always available here for you, and there isn't much time allocated for the presentations from the agency, that it probably would be better for your time just to go ahead with them. But if there are any questions about any of the other material that I've distributed to you, I'd be happy to address that before we move on.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I ask Mr. Bender, I think I made a request early in the session. Have you received the budget, the full budget for OHSU?
Yes. I mean, I've received their financial statements and their overall budget plan.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to make an appointment to come down and see you for about an hour.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. Before we get too far into this, I have looked ahead at the responses to questions asked by the committee, and I don't see a response, unless I'm just missing it, a response to a question I raised about cuts to the Department of Psychiatry. And I believe we heard on the record from Dr. Halleck that there would be a response back to the committee. So if that's in the notebook and I'm just overlooking it, please point it out.
Yes, please come.
It'll be in today's testimony.
Is there a document?
It's a PowerPoint bullet, but there's a
Okay. We should probably go on to Mr. McGee. Mr. McGee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services. You have my handout on the governor's recommended budget, and I'll take you through that fairly quickly. On page 2, you'll see the distribution of the education program area budget and for both the all-funds budget and the general fund and lottery budget. The Oregon Health and Science University is approximately 1% of those amounts. Governor's principal budget, again, this agency would fit entirely within the education principal. On page four, you see again a distribution of the funds in the governor's budget that you are being asked to appropriate this session. $53 million, roughly, or 62% of those are general funds, and $32 million, roughly, or 38% are other funds. The source of those funds are the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, and those dollars are being recommended for the debt service and the opportunity bonds. The state funds, the expenditure of those funds are shown on page 5. About 62%, again, in this case, almost all the general fund is being spent in special payments. Those funds are...
Yes, Representative. Mr. Chair. Mr. McGee, would you back up? You're saying that the other funds is Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement funds are being used to pay the debt?
Yes.
Is that legal?
We would have the Attorney General's advice. We have used that this biennium as well, so... page 5 on the categories for expenditure of the funds, 62% are special payments. That's the transfer of the operational money to the university for its operations. 38% again is the debt service, the master settlement funds that are paid directly by DAS, and there's a very small amount of general fund and services supplies that are used to pay the treasury fees associated with managing the debt on the bonds. Page 6 shows you the distribution of expenditures over time. Again, the governor's budget of $85 million, roughly, including the general fund and the other funds. We will be discussing a proposed recommendation of the governor that would add $3.8 million in general fund to cover the reduction in the School of Nursing program that the board has identified. And then on terms of the governor's issues in developing the budget again, his budget did propose to continue support for the university and hospital operations at a significantly reduced level. Again, as Mr. Bender indicated, the decisions on the most part were left to the Public Corporations Board to make a determination of how those reductions would be managed. The governor, again, is recommending an adjustment of $3.8 million to deal with the reduction the board proposed in the School of Nursing's funding levels. We talked about the payment of debt service and the opportunity bonds using Master Tobacco Settlement Funds. And we are continuing to support the Oregon Poison Center at the existing level. It is currently being funded both from other funds now this biennium and from part of the general fund budget that is transferred to the university. We have no fee or revenue issues or other technical adjustments. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. McGee? Hearing none. Yes, Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, Mr. McGee, what are the annual, what's the annual cost to the state to pay for the principal and interest on the bonds that are state provided to OHSU?
That would be annually the would be half of the $32 million, so it would be about $16 million a year to pay the principal and debt service, the principal and interest.
And that's a 20-year obligation?
Yes.
Thank you.
Anything additional? Okay. Thank you very much. Dr. Kohler and Ms. Hallett, might as well go ahead and bring up Dean Robertson also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Peter Kohler, President of Oregon Health and Science University, and we welcome the opportunity to talk to you today about some of the questions that have been raised. I will be opening this up and leaving a lot of the discussion to Dr. Halleck, our provost, who has been working carefully through the budget. But I wanted to say that I want to go back to the question of the Oregon Opportunity just for a minute to clarify that, I hope. The Oregon Opportunity arose about the time of the tobacco settlement, and the idea was that putting some of that money into research would be a benefit to the state and also would benefit the patients who would have discoveries made that they could then be applied first in Oregon but everywhere. And that would have an economic value as well. that originally started as a revenue bond, and it was converted by a public vote to a general obligation bond, but the expectation we had was that this would continue to be tobacco settlement money. The legalities, I think, have been addressed, but I'm not absolutely sure that they couldn't be restated. But that's how we, you know, ended up with the Oregon opportunity, which is really just in midstream right now. And you'll see more about that later on. I will say that that we would welcome an interim group to be able to discuss our relationship with the state. And I think in terms of coming up with how do we manage the reductions in the budget, this has been discussed fairly extensively with a number of people. Dr. Halleck has been the primary person involved with that, with others. But we did have some principles about how to deal with these reductions, which are shown on this slide here. To protect the educational infrastructure of our schools, because as you know, there's a shortage looming for literally every one of the graduates we provide to the state. We felt it was important to be able to continue to be more self-sufficient. I'm going to show a slide in a minute about our state support level for our operating budget. And as you know, we've had an agreement. The agreement in part became, was part of the public corporation, but that we would have a partnership with the state in carrying out parts of our mission, which are hard to sustain without some public support. So I don't think we've been trying to do anything underhanded with the budget in terms of showing you what the implications are when we have a reduction. Our mission is healing, teaching, discovery, and public service. We try to carry that out to the degree that we can within the limits of our budget. The next one is to provide as much statewide assistance to vulnerable populations as we can. We are a very key part of the safety net, and that is fraying, as you've heard, and I think more work is going to need to be done to protect that for the future, not just at OHSU but elsewhere. We certainly tried to leverage resources where we can and find innovative ways to deliver care to people who are less fortunate. For example, we have nursing clinics in rural areas that we think have been quite valuable and serve as a model. And there are other things that we're looking at doing as well. So these are what we've tried to use as core principles to address our budget issues. And what you're seeing is the result, I think, of a carefully thought-through process. And certainly we're glad to provide what else we do to see what you would like to reduce. I mean, there were discussions, for example, of closing various educational units that derive a large amount of support from the state. We felt it was very important not to do that if that were possible. We're not happy about the tuition increases that have been part of our budget proposal, but we think that's protecting what the state ultimately needs. So we do see this as an important partnership with the state. The phase two questions that we have here, you have before you in the second slide, sort of what we're going to be going through today. And the first part of that is actually going to be responding to questions. Dr. Halleck is going to do that, and I think they're listed for you. I will come back briefly and talk just a little bit about our mission and goals, and then we'll go through the rest of the presentation. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Halleck.
Thank you, Dr. Kohler. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at OHSU. And I wanted to start by addressing the chair and members of the committee with a thank you. The hearings that you've been holding around the state, I'm sure, are difficult both emotionally and physically on top of your day job. But for the people who are most dependent on the state resources at OHSU, it's a wonderful opportunity for them to tell their story. And we very much appreciate being able to answer them when they say, where can we tell our story? And so I thank you for having conducted those hearings. They mean a great deal to all of us. I want to take you through the notebook and tell you what we're going to provide you by way of information today and Monday. I did want to remind you that in the white notebooks, I realize this is sort of notebook heaven here, but in the white notebooks, during the phase one presentation, we did go through a lot of information, and when I met with each of you individually, it provided a very mini packet excerpted from both Phase 1 and Phase 2 that where we outlined the priority setting and how we chose what we did and went through sort of what the implications of each of those choices were. And we'll be covering that in much greater detail now that we're really addressing the budget, including the full budgets of all these units as we go through the next couple of days. What we have in the book are first at the very beginning before you get into the tabs, a sort of Q&A memo to address to Senator Devlin, which just draws your attention to the questions, and I apologize to Senator Gordley in advance, the psychiatry question is embedded in another question here, and it isn't terribly visible in this document, but it is very much in our minds, and Dean Robertson will address it in a little while. I've gone through each of the questions here, and I'll just touch on them very briefly. Some of them just tell you that when we're going to address it, and others where there's a fairly brief response to tell you what it is. But you know, obviously, interrupt, and we can elaborate if you prefer a different order. One of the questions that came up in the last session and in some of these conversations, and just came up, is how do we see your entire budget? And so there's a variety of ways. Our board receives the entire budgets, of course, on every meeting. They receive an updated set of financials. They receive our budgets to approve each year. They receive our audited financials. All of those materials become part of the board docket that are automatically sent to Mr. Bender and Mr. McGee. So those materials, since 1995, always come forward to the state. And, of course, we make them available to anyone who wants to see them. Specifically, to make it a little easier, we have provided that material, and it's under it's in a couple of places. Tab 2 has a summary of the same material that we presented right after the Phase 1 hearing to Mr. Bender and to Senator Walker's staff, and I apologize if that didn't get to your attention directly, Senator Walker, but we did turn it in. And so what we have there are a set of documents that show the approved budgets for 05, compare them to 04. The audited 04 data is in there for the actual completion of 04. So we do an annual budget rather than a biennial budget. So we've shown you both years here. Of course, we're not finished with 05, so those are budgeted figures. We prepare our budget for the board in several forms, and so you see the pages. One is for the university, one is for the hospital, one is then wraps in the restricted budgets, which are grants and contracts, and then there's a consolidated budget. So all that's under tab 2 for you. Now, some of the operating budgets for the future, such as the 06 operating budget, has not yet been approved. It has not yet been completely prepared, but you will see as we go through the material our prediction of what it will be for all the university units, including the schools and CDRC, and that material is provided for you under tab 6. So that's, and you'll see the capital budgets as we come through the presentations. Number 2, again, is kind of a specific subset of the same issue. How do we understand the budgets of each unit? And so we've provided for you exactly what the revenue sources are for all the units. Again, in tab 6, in a complicated spreadsheet, we'll show it to you in some pie charts as we go through the presentation, and we'd be happy to meet individually if you want more information. And the question number 3 had to do with a list of the cuts that we've sustained, and you'll see as we go through this presentation that as part of the directions for the Phase 2 hearings, look back 15 years and a look back 4 years. So we've incorporated that into that presentation. Number 4, what are the impacts on tuition? Again, we've incorporated that into the presentation as we go forward. With regard to the CDRC programs, we were asked in the last hearing to identify, and I believe this was from Representative Jensen, to identify who else provides some of these services. And so under tab 5, we've given a rather elaborate array of what the various clinics and services are that are vulnerable in this budget and what the alternatives are, if there are alternatives. And just a word about about CDRC because I know you saw a lot of heartrending testimony yesterday. They do two principal things with state appropriation. One is that they provide a match to federal funding called Title V funding that actually comes to us through the Health Division. We protected that match in this budget. And the reason Dr. Brian Rogers, and he shared this with you in phase one, protected that is because it serves 10,000 kids statewide. And so in terms of leveraging how we could protect the most people in our budget decision making, protecting the statewide services that they provide in those communities seem to have the greatest amount of leverage. It brings in federal dollars, so, and it provides the most care for the most children. In order to do that, however, what we had to do is look at the entirety of CDRC and determine what clinics we could continue to sustain, where there are reimbursement structures that would allow us to do that, and what clinics were completely dependent on the state appropriation to be sustainable. It's an extremely difficult set of discussions and decisions, but there are some of those programs on the Hill that, if we were going to protect the statewide services, would have to be reduced with this level, this order of magnitude of reduction. So the decision making was really, how do you do the least harm? How do we maximize the amount of care that can be delivered in the context of this budget? We have had at various times a line item for the CDRC budget. Not so in the last couple of biennia. Earlier, it was a line item. In fact, whether or not it was a line item from you, we have sustained it that way. So our budgeting, and that, and Mr. Bender alluded to that, has been very clear. We provide our breakdown of those budgets to the Legislative Fiscal Office each biennia, and we've really held fairly strictly to those allocations that were given to us years ago through the higher ed system. We were also asked about the Poison Center and to provide a budget, and on, I think it's the third page of the memo, the Q&A memo, we have given you this current year's budget for the Fiscal Center, and we were asked to include the grants that come from other areas. There's some, a little money from Alaska, a little from Guam, and so on, and those are included in the memo, just incorporated right into it. We were requested to share some benchmarking on the Poison Center because I alluded to it in the presentation. Our average cost per call is $28.95. The national average of the data that's been collected is $46.15. Varies tremendously. And so we have data from 8 entities, and they range up to over 60 a call, and but the average of those is 46. So we think it's an extremely effective service. On the seventh question here, we were asked to describe some of the information, and I believe this came from Senator Whitsett, about medical malpractice, the reinsurance program operated through the Office of Rural Health. I won't take the time now to go through it, but I've provided some of the details for those of you who are interested in that memo as to how it works. It basically subsidizes malpractice insurance for practitioners who practice in rural areas. There's a particularly advantageous subsidy for obstetricians because that's such a key issue in rural communities in terms of the cost of malpractice insurance for obstetrician gynecologists. And so that program is very valuable to those individuals in terms of being able to continue to practice in those areas. And finally, number 8, we were asked to describe our approach to the care for the underserved, and we will do so in some detail on Monday. And Senator Gordley, we have a report that we've talked to you about we will bring Monday that goes into great detail on that. There is some aspects of the public and child psychiatry that are involved in that as well. You'll hear a little bit about it today and more about it on Monday. And then finally, the South Waterfront Development Project, you'll see in the slides that we'll either address at the end of today or the beginning of Monday, additional information as requested. And number 10, an additional question was on the return on investment of the Oregon Opportunity and how do we report that. We report that in an agreement with the Treasury on a regular basis, and they in turn have an outside consultant that sort of evaluates us and turns in a report to the Treasury, and all those are available to you if you wish from the Treasury. In addition, we've incorporated into the material some of the ROI as we calculate them on specific recruitments. Finally, there was a question. There were a couple of questions on the Dowell School. One is to describe a little bit about the regional Dowell School, and I'll leave that. It's in the memo, and be happy to answer questions if you like. The concept here is really because we're surrounded by a half a dozen states without Dowell schools to really solicit some investment from other states to help expand the capacity. A large number of dentists, whether they're from Oregon or not, who come here do stay here, and so it's another way of addressing shortages, but it's also a way of subsidizing the cost per student in terms of the investment from other resources. So it gives you a little bit of the concept. Now, I will say this is out 5 to 10 years. This is not something that's going to happen in the next year or two. It will require additional capacity. We literally can't take one more student in our class. We don't have chairs to train them. And the pediatric dentistry, we were asked to tell you a little bit about that. The pediatric dentistry program is a residency program. That is, after they graduate as dentists, they can become students again in a residency program. That program was eliminated in the early 90s during Measure 5 reductions. It has been reinstated. We are taking our first two students this next summer, and I'm very pleased to report that yesterday we concluded the site visit from the Commission on Accreditation from the association the Dental Association that accredits this program. And in the exit interview, we had the best possible outcome, a commendation for the investment we've made in the facilities to take care of kids in this training program, and no suggestions or recommendations. So that's accreditation lingo for an incredibly good visit. So we're very pleased, and that program will launch this summer. And finally, we were asked to provide a current affirmative action plan. We provided to you in phase one a material on the student recruitment and retention, and we have some additional material for you in your notebooks. But we did not understand that we were to provide the affirmative action plan. So we have now, which covers all employees. It is in the notebook, and on Monday we'll start off with the director of the Affirmative Action Equal Opportunity Office, who will go over some of that material on Monday, along with some additional material on the student recruitment and some outcome data. We've had this student office now long enough to really have some outcomes in terms of growing this pipeline, and we'll share some of that with you. So that's just orientation for either what's to come or answers to specific questions. I can pause here if there anything else you'd like me to cover in that context.
Well, one thing I've noticed, Dr. Hallock, is that There's a great more detail in this binder than we've previously seen, and I appreciate that, to be quite honest, because it gives me a much clearer view of particularly what the revenue sources are for the various schools. One item I might have, and I don't know because we received these this morning if it's contained in here or not, but could we get... For each school where there is an issue, this will be the School of Medicine, School of Dentistry, and the School of Nursing, basically by year, in the number of years, the number of resident versus non-residents.
Sure.
And that would just give us some clear indication of how many people are being impacted by decisions in terms of if tuition was equalized. I think that's my principal question. Representative Wisnant, I believe, has a question. Or says Wisnant.
You wrote Wisnant to Senator Wisnant.
Oh. Senator Wisnant.
Chair Devlin, Ms. Halleck, employee benefit packages generally are significantly different in the private and the public sector. Now that OHSU is primarily a private sector company, how do OHSU employee retirement benefits compare to private sector peers, and how do OHSU medical insurance premiums benefits for employees compare to private sector peers?
When we became a public corporation in 1995, we essentially inherited the benefit structure of the higher ed system. And we carry that, for the most part, to this day. We still have PERS as a retirement option. We added, as did higher ed, and this was independent because now we were a public corporation, an alternative plan for retirement, a defined contribution plan as opposed to a defined benefit plan. The contribution to that is identical to the contribution for PERS. It was set up that way. So our retirement structure really has not changed principally since 1995. Our health benefits and other benefits have actually eroded since that time. There's a cafeteria plan that allows employees to pick the kind of health insurance they'd like to carry, dental insurance and so on. But the amount, the allowance for that plan is considerably below that that higher ed provides because over the years we haven't had the salary increase money. So our benefit plan, as far as that goes, is really slightly less than it was when we left the state.
Paul, one of the benefits of being a private sector individual or a company is that you would get away from the mandates of the state that are essentially sinking our state. And that would seem that you would address that as a possibility. There are much less inexpensive ways to produce and provide retirement benefits than PERS.
Right.
And I find it personally somewhat appalling that you, in 10 years you haven't addressed that.
Well, the way we tried to address that, it's true, it is an expensive retirement option. And the way we address that is by adding an alternative plan. The advantage of the alternative plan for us is that we can fix the cost, the contribution. And so if the PERS assessment goes up, we're able to hold that. Because it's portable, and more so than PERS, it's attractive to new recruitment, new individuals who come to the institution. So what we've done is we've tried to, and really to address your point, we've tried to structure it in such a way to incentivize people to opt into what we call the university plan, which has a known cost to us and is not sort of subject to the overhead and the issues around PERS. And that's worked reasonably well for new employees. People who had been in the PERS plan for decades when we became a public corporation, because of the structure of the public corporation, do have the ability to stay in PERS, and many have. So we have a hybrid, and so we've tried to do just what you said, create a sort of more nimble program that gives people an alternative, but honor all the contractual arrangements we have with unions and so forth, and for those individuals who still remain in PERS.
Follow up?
Yes.
Are you constrained by any state law or regulation to continue to provide PERS retirement to your employees, or is this a corporate choice?
It's a contractual obligation that we have with the unions. It's part of our legislation. It could conceivably, I suppose, be changed, but I'd need to consult with legal to see how that could be done, if it could be done. I'm not aware that it can be.
Contractual regulation, contracts have a term, and they should be renegotiable at the end of that term. Have you renegotiated any of those contracts or attempted to renegotiate any of those contracts with your employee unions to attempt to develop a more cost-effective retirement plan?
We have, in the sense that we have the alternative university plan, and we've made that an option. So all employees have both options. We haven't attempted to negotiate a contract that eliminates the PERS option. And I'm not, I don't know the answer to whether we could or not.
Yes, Dr.
This is written into the legislation in terms of what we agreed to at the time we became a public corporation, which is really a hybrid. I mean, there was an expectation that we were in a partnership with the state, but to get the legislation passed, excuse me, at the time, we did continue the PERS option. And our structure is more favorable with regard to PERS than some of the other entities that use that. Our solution was, in fact, to create this defined contribution plan and to gradually phase more people over to the defined contribution plan over the years, and that is working. But there are a lot of legal things, and I believe it is safe to say that to change the PERS option would require legislation or a change in our legislation.
not being an attorney, but having gone through far too many PERS hearings, the issue probably with there, it's not simply the collective bargaining agreement that has a beginning and ending date. It's the court's interpretation that since granting those PERS retirement rights to that employee at the time of their employment, that those rights are vested with that employee for the duration of their employment, regardless of the length of the collective bargaining agreement. That's the basic way the court decisions have come down, and it's probably not an issue here for a budget committee, but I think there are a number of opinions that could be cited in that regard. One of the things, I want to go back to Senator Whitsitt because I don't believe he's finished yet, so then I have some more questions.
Okay. One follow-up question then is the defined contribution plan that you have established, is that significantly less expensive for the OHSU system, or is it on a par basis?
At the present time, it's about on a par basis. We do believe that over time it will become much less expensive. It is a 6% match, and we have continued the pickup concept. So, you know, in terms of what a relationship to PERS, it's about even right now.
Thank you.
Okay. With regard to your PERS obligations, have you issued, I believe the terminology, I'm trying to remember it, have you issued the PERS obligation bonds to cover part of your long-term liabilities, or are you part of the state pool in terms of the pension obligation bonds?
We're a separate pool within the state.
Okay.
So I think that's how it's operating.
So you have not actually issued pension obligation bonds to try to lower your liability long term? No. Okay. One thing that's my personal curiosity, and it's probably shouldn't be the subject of this hearing, could you send me a copy of what your health and dental plans are that you offer?
Sure.
It's a long term interest of looking at the cost of public health and dental and vision plans. Additional questions from the committee at this point?
Chair Devlin, just one other question, if I might.
Yeah.
Could you provide to the committee the rate of increase of cost over the last two biennia and the projected or increase in cost over the next two biennia of your medical health insurance premium plan and your PERS retirement plans, please? Thank you.
So we have formed our own PPO as part of our menu in order to reduce the costs, we believe, and that's in process right now.
I think one other piece of information that in order to address those costs and try and bring those down, one of the things we were free to do as a result of the legislation was to recast those, as you suggest. And because there are so many plans offered in the plan to which state agencies are part, the cost per plan isn't quite as competitive. We were able to form a menu of fewer options, basically. And as a result, the bidders bid more favorably, and that's helped us control those costs a little bit. So we have been able to manage it more effectively with the degrees of freedom that we were able to obtain, and we'll bring you those numbers.
At this point, please proceed.
Okay. The next slide just shows you a sort of an overview here of the program priorities from a financial perspective. I might comment that we believe that we've used this term leveraging, and people say, what in the world do you mean by leveraging? And I think what we intend to mean by that is taking support that we do get from the state and using it to carry out our entire mission to the best of our ability. Healing, teaching, discovery, and public service all have their own constituencies, and what we've tried to do is keep as much going as possible. We have also tried to make our operations as transparent as we can, understanding that our budget is very complicated. The next particular chart shows really taking our budget back to 1975. I was recruited in 1988, and the percent of our budget that was provided by the state at that time was 27%. We were part of higher education, and really we understood that we had about $400 million of deferred maintenance at that time that was not being accommodated for us nor the rest of higher ed, which also had deferred maintenance. It was things of that sort that led us to form the public corporation. And Chairman Devlin, you are correct in that the understanding at the time this was formed back in 1993 was that we would reduce our appropriation from the state, now called the grant, and hold that steady for two biennia. Beyond that, we had anticipated that our needs would be inflated as we provided more, and that was sort of, I think, where some misunderstanding has occurred and why I think an interim task force would be a very good idea to sort out our relationship. But you can see there, our operating budget has grown rather extensively. In absolute dollars, over the past several biennia, you can see that our grant has diminished. This is the operating grant. Does not show the money for the capital expenditures involved in the Oregon Opportunity. And you can see calculated on that the state appropriation is a percent of our total budget. I think the yellow line is worth pointing out because this is where we provide immediate value to the state. This is our grant award number. This will show up later. And you can see also we have grown rather substantially in terms of the number of employees that we have. By the way, when we recruit, we tend to try to use the 50th percentile for people in relevant positions on the West Coast or nationally as we recruit people here. They have to be attracted. We think we have advantages in Oregon in recruiting, but that's where some of the numbers come in that that I think may look large to some of the people involved on the committee. Look at the next slide. This shows OHSU total revenue. You can see how that has grown. And the one that led to the Oregon Opportunity was the Research Awards in the next one. And you can see there we've had a little plateauing 2003-2004 in part because we lack the facilities. That's what's under construction right now as part of the Oregon Opportunity building. And these buildings will be able to be occupied in approximately 8 to 10 months from now, at least the first one of those. And we hope and expect, even though the NIH budget has plateaued, to see that number begin to increase again. We are next in some pie charts, and I'm going to turn these over to Dr. Halleck to describe to you.
Thank you, President Kohler. I'm going to go through the next few very quickly, but please, I'm sure you will, interrupt if you want more details. You've seen many of these, so it's really just to remind you that if you look at the overall OHSU budget, slightly more than half of it, and this is described pretty nicely in Mr. Bender's memo as well, is really the hospital and clinic. And so that's represented here as red patient care revenue, and a large proportion, 36.5% in the O5 budget, really comes in through gifts and grants and contracts. So the yellow represents research for the most part, or very directed grants, might be for a training purpose. The blue and green and a good bit of the gray there represent the educational mission, and I've broken those out in this slide. And it shows you that we teach students with approximately a third tuition as a resource, a third the state appropriation, and a third money we bring in from either scholarships or training grants or institutional resources. So it's and in fact that looks very much like the higher ed resource picture for student capitation data, and our capitation data is, has that same set of parameters. If you then break it out by unit, and this is a colored depiction, one of the tabs that I directed you to earlier, I believe it is tab 6, yes it is, gives the actual numbers behind all these colored pie charts. So if you really want the detail of how many dollars are in a given school, whether it's from tuition or grants or patient revenue, it's all in that tab 6, and I'd be happy to meet with you individually, go over it, or we can provide any additional detail. But it gives you a feel for, hopefully, the fact that the schools are funded by multiple sources. The educational component of these circles, the schools of nursing, dentistry, and medicine, as well as the allied health programs, have a significant research component, and then they have an educational mission. And roughly speaking, the tuition and the state appropriation are about the same order of magnitude in terms of their support. I'm not going to say anything more about that because I have a dean here that's going to speak to you a little bit more specifically about the medical school. I do want to point out, and another version of this graph is actually in the material from Mr. Bender as well, that we have very different financial picture for the university than for the hospital. And in the case of the university really does not break even yet. We're hoping to reach a point where it will, and we're on a plan to get us there in a number of years, but it does not break even and would not, short of about a $2 billion endowment. So that's about where we are in terms of what it would take to have a fully self-sustaining private-like university. The hospital, depending on the circumstances and the years, does generate a positive bottom line, and that's what makes up for those gaps that you see on the university and provides the capital to invest in replacing equipment and enhancing capacity both for all kinds of care that's delivered as well as the educational mission. So it's very important to understand the dynamic and the interaction between those two sides of the OHSU program all taken together. And one of the things that happened in 1995 is that we were allowed to issue debt. We were allowed to go to the bond market, obtain bonds, and one of the things we were able to do with those bonds is renovate the hospital. That allowed us to compete much more effectively, frankly, in the health system market and really change the revenue picture. And if you go back and look at the history of the hospital, if you go back further into the 80s, you would see negative numbers there. And it really wasn't until we could start investing capital in the hospital that it started generating a consistent positive bottom line that could help sustain the university side without having to continually come back and ask for additional resources, both on the capital and operating side.
Provost Halleck, I think most of the committee members here would be aware that the investment in the hospital, particularly in terms of the existing hospital at that time, your facility was falling apart. It was in pretty a pretty diminished standard of quality. So
thank you.
Remember also, I think I mentioned last time, a bill was introduced to close the university hospital at about that time.
It is certainly true, and this debt that we've taken on has really been to turn that around, sort of system by system, ward by ward.
Representative Woodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, would you? I'm not in this kind of money, so can you tell me what a capital lease and the DSPA and the OGA bonds?
This is where we bring Irene up. I have with me the assistant comptroller who can help with some of this. And this is Irene Barheit, who's the assistant comptroller at OHSU.
The probably the hardest one on there is the debt service payment agreement. And when we became a public corporation, we assumed the debts that were on, I don't know if it was the state system or higher ed, thank you. And so there's a written agreement between us and the state that we will service our debt that way. So we make payments on that ourselves. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
So that's the DSPA, but what's a capital lease?
Capital lease, that's a small amount of dollars that we have out in debt, and that is the majority of that is for capital equipment purchases.
Well, a lease is not a purchase.
Lease purchase.
So capital lease is where you basically end up with the asset at the end of the lease.
Okay.
So it looks like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the OGI, Oregon Government. What is that?
That was mentioned earlier as far as the OGI school is now a part of our OGI School of Science and Engineering. And when they became a part of us, they had debt.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You might as well stay here, I mean, because the next slide it gives you some numbers behind the benchmarks, the performance measures, basically, against which we are measured, both in the performance measures that you have in the legislative report and have given back to us, but also as we're judged by those who loan us money in the form of the bonds you just saw. And, I mean, I might as well just have you address these performance measures, kind of what they are.
Our debt service coverage ratio measures the amount of cash, basically, that we bring in a given year, divided by the amount of our debt service that we have in a given year. And so what we, on all of these, I'm afraid we want to be higher, is you measure us against the S&P AA rating. But at this time, it's 2004, it's about 2 times our debt service. The total margin measures the amount of our net income divided by our revenues. And again, if you measure it against the S&P AA standard, we would like it to be higher. The days in accounts receivable is the hospital accounts receivable. And as you can see, we had some times there that the ratio was favorable than it is now, and I think that's a sign of the economy. Our days cash on hand measures the amount of cash that we have in reserves, and again, if we're comparing ourselves to others, we would like that to be higher.
And I think we give this to you as part of the performance measure reporting, but I think you can see that we have, in fact, on the days of cash on hand, improved since 1995. Bond market wasn't too happy with the sort of way you structure your finances when you're a public entity, and so they've asked us to increase that. They'd like to see it, as Irene indicated, at more like 200, but 120 to 150 would make them much happier than where we are now. So we're constantly keeping our eye on that parameter. There's some information here about bond ratings. I won't take the committee's time to go through, but if you have specific questions about the bond ratings and how we enter that market, the cost of the bonds is very much dependent on a healthy sort of ability to pay them back, just like a mortgage rate is. Provided for you now some... I'm sorry.
Senator Whitsitt has a question.
Mr. Devlin, Ms. Halleck, going back to this, look at financial ratios and your days in accounts receivable. That seems kind of high. I wonder if is that comparable to other private sector hospitals, or is that a result of the third-party payment system?
That and the fact that we're an academic health center and we have a significant population that's served by Medicaid and Medicare, and so there's a third party and a fourth party, and there's a series of interactions. My understanding is that actually, if you compare yourself to other academic health centers, this looks very good. You might want to address that. I mean,
correct. That S&P rating that's out there, it does have private hospitals. It's a blend between the two, but if you compare us just to academic medical centers, our days in accounts receivable is very favorable.
And one follow-up, do your accounts receivable bear interest? Do you charge interest on your accounts receivable?
Eventually, but not for the first 30 days for sure, and I don't recall for in terms of 60 whether we do. Eventually, actually, they're turned over to a collection agency. So it just depends on how old the debt is. We can give you the policy on that if you'd like the details. It's fairly standard market policy, but each hospital has a different one in terms of how they manage that.
Thank you.
Can I shouldn't interrupt, but The whole medical reimbursement system is broken. And basically, you submit a bill, it goes over to an insurance company or an agency. Their accountants and bookkeepers look at it and refuse part of it. It comes back to you. You then re-justify it and send back again. And this interaction can go on multiple times before finally the bill is actually paid. This creates a great deal of inefficiency. It's a full employment act almost for billing clerks, but it really has to be changed. But compared to most academic health centers, this really looks pretty good. So I think we're doing as well as long as we have to live with the current system.
Thank you. Chair Devlin, one yeah. further thing. That, I think, points out one of the in my opinion, the difficulties with medical service delivery, and that is that there isn't any negotiation at the point of service, and so subsequently you have a negotiation at the point of payment.
That's really true. I think at this point, partly because of who I have here with me today, I'm going to do a slight adjustment given with an eye to the clock, because if the committee will indulge me, I will come back to the operating and capital budgets, but it's fairly complicated, and I would like to have Dean Robertson present to you today. So if you're willing for me to skip ahead a little bit.
I think that would be good for both. One thing for the committee, and I think just for the record, the $200 million in bonds that were issued are actually state obligations.
Right.
And maybe if you could just comment briefly on the process we had to go through to do that.
Because the original concept in legislation was fairly flexible, it allowed a couple of ways those bonds could have been issued. One was as revenue bonds, basically. But the other, because at the time, to issue them as a general obligation bond of the state, which has a lower interest rate, would not have been allowed because OHSU was not allowed to be the recipient of a general obligation bond. In order to convert that revenue bond concept to a general obligation concept, it actually took a constitutional amendment. And there was a statewide initiative that really passed with an overwhelming majority that allowed OHSU to become eligible for general obligation bonds. So the bonds were then issued by the state as general obligation. That allowed them to be cheaper, basically, to have a lower interest rate and for us to receive more proceeds from them. And so we received the full 200 instead of a lesser amount, as it would have been. I think it would have been 167, if I remember the number correctly. Is that right? Had they been revenue bonds. So it was definitely a nice outcome of the ballot initiative, but the state cost was the same either way. What I'd like to do now is just talk a little bit about specific units, and we decided, since you had heard from nursing and CDRC last time, and there's the School of Medicine, which we listed as our highest priority in those programs that would receive funding in the governor's recommended budget, thought it would be helpful for you to hear from the dean of the School of Medicine and to understand a little bit about the dynamics between the school and the health system. So I'm going to skip ahead. I do want to just show you one bit of data about the School of Medicine and then bring Dr. Robertson up. We have a series of pie charts in here to give you a historical perspective of all those revenue sources we've been describing. And I apologize that we seem to have 2004 on one side on the left and 2000 on the right. Most of us think kind of the other way around. But the green here represents the state component of funding in the School of Medicine. And although it looks like a small percent, if you think of all the yellow as research grants, which they essentially are, take them out, it's a significant component of the educational mission. And you can see that even prior to this discussion about the next biennia, between 2000 and 2004, the state appropriation had been diminished significantly in the School of Medicine. But it's still comparable to the tuition in terms of being equal partners in supporting that educational mission. And I'm going to skip all these other units. We can come back to them. Show you this one, which is the School of Medicine as projected into the 06 budget. And there's about a $2 million drop, $2.5 million drop. And then I'm just going to go ahead and see and call Dr. Robertson up, and we'll come back to some of this. I apologize. Okay. this evening.
Okay. I'm Joe Robertson, Dean of the School of Medicine. Senator Devlin, committee members, I thank you very much for this opportunity to come talk to you today, and I want to add my appreciation to that that's been expressed by Drs. Kohler and Halleck. I think I gained a renewed appreciation for both the enormity and complexity of the challenge that you face as you deal with the budget for this biennium when I went to the public hearing at PCC Cascade and listened to the compelling cases presented by all the constituent groups that testified before you. So, and I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you, and I hopefully convince you why an investment in the School of Medicine at this particular time will yield decades, dividends for decades to come for the citizens of Oregon. I've tried to make mental note of some of the questions and concerns that have been raised during the first part of the proceedings here today, and we'll try and adapt what I have here to make sure that those are addressed, and if they're not, please interrupt me, because that is certainly my intent. I want to start out with just a few slides that some people would call the bragging rights, but we have a great School of Medicine, one that we're proud of, and I think one that all Oregonians should be proud of. We do very well in the national rankings. We're ranked second in primary care, second in community health, third in family medicine. We're basically swamped with applicants. We think that we'll have over 3,500 to 3,600 applicants for this fall's class. One third of all pediatric applicants for residency and one fourth of all internal medicine applicants apply to our school, and I just have some new data. We're approaching 40% of all ophthalmology applicants for graduate training applying to OHSU. Our graduates do very well. They match in the disciplines of their choice, and they have very high scores on their boards. The School of Medicine has continued to grow. I would say in many aspects the growth has been rather dramatic. The clinical practice has risen 9% annually over the past 3 years, and that's been very fortunate this particular time, because at the time of diminishing state support, I mean, we've come to rely upon that for programmatic support on the academic side of the house. Research funding increased 12% in FY in 2003, and we have several units now that have reached the top 10 status with regard to research ranking nationally. Also, I want you to be aware that the School of Medicine is much more than a place that trains doctors, and now, as you see, students in basic biomedical sciences, public health, biomedical informatics, and the other disciplines outnumber medical students. The MCAT, that's the Medical College Admissions Test, is the test that prospective medical students take. We do considerably better than our students do very well on that and score above the national average. The same is true with regard to the pass rate when they take their licensing boards at the conclusion of medical school. Now, I want to turn specifically to the impact of the proposed budget as it relates to the School of Medicine. And again, I think in an effort to address the concern that was raised earlier about how do you select what programs are affected, I want you to know that the instructions that I give to the department chairs when we talk about budgets, I say first and foremost, do the right thing. And doing the right thing for me as dean in the School of Medicine involves, above all else, protecting the School of Medicine. We are the only place in the state of Oregon that trains physicians. As you'll see in subsequent parts of this presentation, there's a compelling need to train more physicians, so we try and maintain the integrity of that educational process, and we also try and set the stage for our ability to continue to increase the number of medical students that we train. But the proposed budget will mean that we will need to raise our resident tuition by approximately $10,000 a year. Nobody knows the impact of that, I think, on the students more than I do. I'm the one that has to talk to them. I'm the one that has to break this news to them. But if you wonder, why is that this really necessary, I think it's important to, I think about comparators. If we look to the north, the University of Washington receives $55 million of state support. If we look to the south, UCLA School of Medicine receives $120 million of state support. The western average is $48 million. I mean, I literally stand here before you as a dean saying if we even received the western average, we would accept 100 medical students from Oregon and charge them no tuition. This is something that is very near and dear to me. Our tuition structure is what it is because it's essential for the financial survival of the school.
Dr. Robinson, just for clarification, if you had to raise it $10,000, would there be no distinction between resident and non-resident tuition?
What that does is raise the resident tuition to the non-resident. And, you know, certainly I don't like that. I mean, I stand here before you admitting that. But I also would tell you that what that has done is place our tuition at the mid-range of private medical schools across the country. But those private and that's actually in many ways who we're now competing with. Unfortunately, we have a quality of school where we can do that. But those private schools have large endowments, which we do not. And now several of those private schools actually receive more support than we are currently slated to receive. Baylor receives $10 million as a private school for sitting in the state of Texas. And our previous dean, Dr. Joe Bloom, has gone to Philadelphia to be interim dean. He couldn't stand retirement, so he came out of retirement. And he's interim dean for a year at Drexel University in Philadelphia. They're a private institution that receives $10 million of state funding to enhance the activities of their medical school. So that, I think with that, I give you that information to help you understand why that tuition structure is necessary.
And Dr. Robertson, the issue in terms of without the state funding and having to replace that with higher tuition, the underlying issue that you're trying to present to us is that if you don't get one of those revenue sources, you diminish the quality of your programs, and you diminish the quality of your programs, then you basically drop in national rankings, you drop in applicant pool.
Well, and it's not only drop in national rankings, we actually, if I can go back a little further, and I'm spending longer than I meant to on this particular topic, but if you really want to go back and look at this over the past several years, I was interim dean in 2001, and that was the 2001 biennium was when the School of Medicine took a first major hit. The expectation at that time was that we would diminish the number of students in the school. I did not want that to be my legacy as the interim dean, that we diminished the class size when I knew in a few years that we would face a significant physician shortage. The strategies that we've embarked upon all along have been those that we think are necessary to maintain or increase the size of the class. That has been the fundamental driver, and so that's really what's driven the tuition structure. The other impacts are, we don't want to reduce the number of students. We are concerned that our rural elective will have to be, our rural rotation will have to be changed to an elective rather than a required rotation. The students will probably have reduced training experiences in psychiatry, OBGYN, pediatrics, and internal medicine. Still sufficient for accreditation, but probably not to the same degree as they currently experience. We are slated to close our Division of Molecular Medicine. This was our premier research division within the Department of Internal Medicine, but to maintain it as a separate division was a cost of approximately $600,000 a year, which we did not think we could justify in the current environment. And there will be significant reductions in postgraduate training in child psychiatry and public psychiatry. And I hope someone will convey this to Senator Walker, because I know that she expressed concerns about how, why some programs were slated to be cut that seemed to be serving the those less fortunate. So I'll dive into the specifics of the budget of that department. The Department of Psychiatry receives roughly $1.6 million from the dean's office in their state budget each year. That's probably at least twice the amount that other departments receive, either on a per educational hour basis or per faculty basis. Okay, and we had hoped to move more of our budget to what is called mission-based budgeting, so we would be distributing the funding based upon the educational production by the faculty. But we found that if we did that, these programs that are there for the benefit of the underserved would be even more severely impacted. The Department of Psychiatry received a reduction in their budget of about $200,000 this year. This decision was not made by me, but it was made by the department chair, someone who has a very sincere interest. He came and talked to me about that. He fully understands the ramifications. But again, it gets back to the fundamental issue, and that is preserving our school and our accreditation, and those programs are not necessarily for accreditation. So he felt that he really didn't have any choice other than to direct the cut in those areas.
To what extent, Dr. Robertson, if the budget request that you had forwarded to the governor had been funded, would any of these cuts still occur?
I think we still would have had to raise tuition. Okay, I sit here before you confident that we can restore the programs in psychiatry, but I also sit here before you confident that even if every aspect of the proposed budget is restored, we will still have to have significant tuition increases. But not as much, yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Picking up on what you just said, am I understanding that you will be able to restore the cut to psychiatry?
I will do that, yes. We will do that. That is at the very top of our list.
The $200,000, is that?
I think it's $200,000 to $250,000. I have to look exactly, yes.
I had understood it was $400,000.
So. No, that's for the biennium. It's for the biennium. You're talking biennium, I think, annually.
Right. Okay. I raised the question at a earlier hearing, and then again at the beginning of this hearing, because I wanted to just establish a concern for the record. And I'm pleased to hear that there is a commitment to make the restoration. At a time when communities need OHSU's expertise to help implement and evaluate evidence-based mental health services in underserved communities, and I'm going to speak now particularly about the needs in the African American community. Hearing about the cut to psychiatry was disturbing and led to questioning and wondering what that reduction would mean in terms of jeopardizing an opportunity for OHSU to partner with mental health professionals in the African American community, who I know are committed to a partnership with OHSU, and who see the opportunity to grow and enhance culturally competent and responsive services, in fact, grow capacity in the for African American citizens. So this opportunity goes directly to the need to better serve a historically underserved community that has been underserved in all aspects of healthcare including mental health concerns. So I just didn't want to see us missing out on an opportunity just as this community initiative was taking root and getting off the ground and people looking at OHSU as a natural partner.
Yeah. No, we very much want to take advantage of not only that opportunity, but similar opportunities. I've had other discussions about this, not only with Dr. George Keepers, the chair, but Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson, who has very, very deep interest in this as well. This is one of our top priorities for restoration. And literally, it just, as we went through the budget, we could not, in good conscience, leave the Department of Psychiatry unaffected. And after considerable deliberations with the chair, this was just a very unfortunate but seemingly unavoidable decision.
And I would just say in closing that, again, looking at OHSU's role in the Oregon community, the opportunity in front of us that I've tried to very briefly describe and define is huge, and there's the potential for it to become another crown, another jewel in the crown, if you will, for OHSU. I know we have these concerns about what should be the state's role in supporting OHSU, and you know, you're being presented with some hard questions and hearing some constructive criticism. I think that's as it should be. That's our role as legislators. But I just want to be real clear from where I sit, looking at OHSU's economic impact on Oregon, the Oregon community, you know, I'm not mad at OHSU. I want to clearly understand, you know, what are the issues we need to better understand so that we can take full advantage of this partnership between the state and OHSU. But again, I just see the opportunity in this session, to—I'll just say—you know—everybody put their cards on the table. Let's be real frank and open and honest about what the concerns are. But let's leave this session clearly understanding that the state does have a role in keeping this partnership alive and well and healthy. And again, I think about those students that we saw last night, all those students who stood up. And as I saw them, Mr. Chair, my thought was that's our investment, not just in those individual students, but that's our investment in Oregon's future. And so let's try to keep that in front of us as we continue to discuss these issues.
Ms. Sargent, Dr. Roberts, we have two people in line. If I'm looking, Dr. Robertson, Representative Jensen, then Senator Nelson.
A couple of things. First. The molecular medicine division. You're talking about clothes, the molecular medicine division. Explain to me what parts of the university are going to be affected by that closure.
This, in the Department of Medicine, which is a clinical department, there was established a unit which was responsible for doing basic science, understanding the various diseases at really the cellular and subcellular level. We supported that in an amount of roughly $600,000 a year in excess of the amount of funding that they could obtain through grants and other means. Okay. So what we've done is disband that as a division, but we think we are going to be able to save, I mean, to maintain places for all of the faculty. That's not a guarantee yet, but they will be redistributed. Probably four of them will end up in the Department of Biochemistry. And
you know, the maintaining of faculty and all that is certainly something that is of interest, but my particular, what part of the program that is going to be most adversely, or could be, and is that going to be mostly applicable to internal medicine?
It's mostly applicable.
And will that have a negative effect upon our rank and status in the area of internal medicine?
Yes, it will have a ranking on our, an impact on our research and ranking in internal medicine.
Therefore, it gives me, and I thought that's the answers I was going to get, and therefore it gives me some considerable heartburn, because I look at 1/4 of all the internal medicine applicants nationally apply to HSU, which would indicate we have done something to become credible.
Right.
In the nation with it. And that's all I wanted on that, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the area of psychiatry, though, if I could, and the particular concern with it is the area of child psychiatry. My personal experience, limited that it is, especially in rural Oregon, we have a major problem, and I mean major problem as far as child psychiatry is concerned. Now, you all do a good job with this. I'm not, you know, I'm not suggesting that OHSU isn't there to provide consult work and, you know, some of those things, but that's not the same thing as good, if I can use this term, on-the-ground child psychiatrists up in our communities. And so cuts in that program would also give me some heartburn.
And it gives us great heartburn as well.
And that was all I had.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gorley sort of struck some chords with me. I mean, I agree 100% with that. I thought our charge on this committee was to pick those programs that were giving us the most bang for the dollar. And, you know, here we are talking about cutting programs. I think follows what Representative Jensen said. I mean, we really ought to be advocating for restoring the whole $32 million and saying, let's go forward. I mean, if I get down to the point where I have to choose between the Department of Education's operating budget and something, you know, whether it's the hospitals or the clinics, I'm going to choose the hospital and clinics. So I just want to, you know, put the committee on notice. I mean, this is where we're getting the most bang for the buck. I don't care about the data I get from the Department of Education. I care about it. These folks out there taking care of my people. So I just need a little passion that the good Senator brought out.
Well, Senator Nelson, I don't know if I should say this publicly, but I feel in a kind of a difficult position because I feel like we actually have about a 10-member committee, because I've got the 8 members here, and then I got 2 co-chairs.
And a couple of vice chairs.
And to some degree, I wish... Well, I won't say that. So, please.
In the spirit of the free and open discussion that's occurring, I think I'm going to deviate then just a minute longer from the prepared text and tell you, because, I mean, you mentioned, in essence, return on investment, and I want you to understand that per dollar, the state of Oregon is getting the best return of investment of NIH dollar out of the medical school on dollar invested by the state than any school in the country. There is no one that's even a close second. I haven't run exactly this number, but I was just running it through in my head. I think the same thing can be said with regard to number of medical students trained per dollar invested. So I think you can go forth and say that we have been good stewards of the financial support that we've been given. The other thing that I would like to make sure that this committee feels, just as I can feel your support for OHSU, I want to be sure that you understand that that I'm here as a representative of the faculty who very much share that commitment. We have a, I call it the Medical Education Improvement Fund. The faculty call it the Dean's Tax. But that's a 7.8% assessment on all their clinical collections, not charges, but actual collections. And that's before net of expenses. That's among the highest in the country. But the support, the direct financial support of the faculty for the institution and its causes goes much beyond that. Last year, 30% of the money earned on the clinical side went to support the academic mission. This year, and it's gone up every year. And this year, the projections show that at 34%. So the faculty are making choices that they are supporting the missions of the university rather than taking that money home as income. And I think it's important that that be understood. I will go quickly now through, I think, some of the next several slides. Okay. The next several slides are demographic slides. The first shows that despite our best efforts, we've probably just about maximized utilization rates in medicine. The system is not going to become a lot more efficient, at least in Oregon. There's not a lot of cost savings in that manner, but the thing that, because these are one year after another practically superimposed, but if you will look at this graph, you will see what is obvious to all of us, that you use more health resources as you get older. Okay, these graphs are supposed to become progressively scary, so to speak, because then if you look at the next graph, you will see how the population is aging. And the third graph then is the rapid growth of the population in our country, even more rapidly than anticipated. The net effect of that is that we are going to now, people anticipate that we will have a 20% shortage of physicians in this country by the year 2020. That is new news to most people. They've been talking about a nurse shortage for years, but now we are right on the cusp of a real physician shortage. But unfortunately, the pipeline to create those physicians is a minimum of 12 years from the time somebody makes a decision. We train the same number of medical students now that we did in the early 80s. It hasn't changed over a generation. And in Oregon, we used to feel confident that this is such a great state and great place to live. Well, this is not our problem because we don't have to build it and they will come anyway. Well, that no longer is true. Our physician reimbursement profile is no longer favorable, nor is the malpractice climate particularly favorable. And as a physician shortage confronts the country, it will become increasingly difficult to supply this state with the physicians that it needs. And I think in the graph that one shows that now the growth of the population in Oregon has outstripped the growth of the physicians. The next graph shows that our physicians are aging, so just as the time the baby boomers begin to retire, the physicians will also begin to retire. The next graph is particularly frightening to me in that over the next 2 years, this is from the OHSU Office of Rural Health, the survey they've done, 13% of physicians plan to exit Oregon's workforce during that period of time. We will graduate roughly 200 to 216 students from the OHSU School of Medicine. The back one, I think, or no, oh. Let's see, I skipped over something. I'm sorry. Yeah. This slide. No, I want to. Yeah. This shows how we have not kept pace, that the number of medical students trained per capita is diminishing. The fact here that's particularly alarming is that in Oregon, our medical students trained per capita is only half that of the national average. Okay. The good news is, as Dr. Halleck turns to this slide, we do have lots of applicants applying, so if we build it, we can admit them. Okay. And so I think we're going to, I think we'll skip over these. We've hit the highlights. So this is a real crisis that's looming out there. It's something that I feel this every day. I'm as passionate about this issue as Eddie. And I think that we need to do things in the state to secure the future supply of physicians. We are working actively toward that end. Some of the and the solutions, we're not requesting any new money at this time for that. We're just asking the restoration of our budget. As I've told you, that we've continued to increase the number of medical students despite the declining state support. We will be up to 112 students this year. We intend to sort of knock out a little corner next to the anatomy lab and try and go to 120 the following year. We are developing interdisciplinary models to teach team-based practice. We are trying to work cooperatively not only to enhance the educational model, but I think to eventually improve the practice model with the other schools at OHSU. And since I'm out of time, I'm going to skip to the last slide because I want you to know that we are actively engaging in developing several programs that we think will ultimately result in more physicians practicing in the state of Oregon. We have a rural scholars program where we are trying to identify, even before admission, those people that may be more inclined to practice in a rural setting. We have talked to the admissions committee and have convinced them that rural heritage should also be considered as a factor with regard to diversity. We have signed a letter of intent with the University of Oregon in hopes that we can establish a branch campus in Eugene. There are laboratories at the University of Oregon that we think we would be able to use for the laboratory studies in our basic science courses. And Peace Health is actually the largest hospital between Portland and San Francisco. They have a CEO that is very much aware of the impending physician crisis. I know him personally, and so we've signed a letter of intent between University of Oregon, Peace Health, and OHSU to see if we can develop a branch campus there that I think would allow us to add an additional 20 to 40 students, maybe on the average of 30, that over the next few years give us hopes of increasing our total class to 100 to 150 students. So, again, I thank you for this opportunity to come and talk to you, and we'll continue to welcome any questions and would encourage you to be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Robertson. We're actually at the conclusion of today's hearing. Dr. Kohler and Dr. Halleck, we will be back Monday. I regret that we had to change your schedule, and I hope that works out. We will start first thing Monday, and hopefully we can finish up this phase Monday. Committee, we will bypass health licensing boards next week. You can tell that creates a great deal of angst for me, but but we will go to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission on Tuesday. And I believe to the Teacher Standard and Practice Commission of the State Library on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we must be back for another public hearing, aren't we?
Yes, Thursday is the public testimony day for OUS.
Oh, for the Oregon University System. Well, with that, thank you very much for your presentation today, and thank you very much for the detailed information that was requested.
Thank you.
Close the hearing and close this meeting.
Are you going to